Welcome to What Matters Now, a weekly deep dive into what's happening on the ground right now. I'm Amanda Borchel Dan, joined in this informal conversation with the Times of Israel senior analyst Chaviv Retegour. Hi, Chaviv.
Hey, Amanda. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and it's so nice to have you in the same time zone for a limited time.
Yes, we went on a family vacation. Tickets were bought 10 months ago before there was any war, before there was any of the drama today. But luckily, the tickets weren't canceled and our kids got a little bit of time out and we got some family time. But we're back. We're diving in. We're good. Let's do this.
Chaviv, I just have to ask you, how did it feel to be outside the country when Iran finally struck Israel?
Yes, I have already been asked, including on social media, whether I knew. I was flying out, and what does Chaviv know? So once again, 10 months ago, these tickets were bought. But no, seriously, it was awful. It was actually awful. For one thing, we're suddenly starting to think about, well, what if we're stuck in Thailand 3 more weeks? So we have to go to some third country because the airspace over Israel is shut down because there's a missile war with Iran. I think 3 days before we were due to come back, 2 planes from Thailand to Tel Aviv were actually turned back by just Israeli airport authorities that couldn't guarantee their safety. So it was scary. It was scary to watch. Jerusalemites sent us footage of the missiles coming in and being intercepted over them, literally over their heads, glowing in the night sky. So it was very dramatic, very scary to think about friends and loved ones who are here. I got to tell you, even though the target of the attack was Israel, to me in Thailand, it felt safer to be in Israel. Because in Israel, everyone's around and you know what's happening. And I have, of course, a bomb shelter room in my house, like everybody, like you, like everyone has to by law. And I have everyone around me who, you know, we all protect each other and we're there for each other. So it felt strange. We were at a nice hotel in the middle of an island off the coast of Thailand, right? We were not suffering, but it felt bad.
It was very strange for me. But on the other hand, it feels like ancient history in a way. And so much has happened since then all over the world of interest to the Jewish world and Israel. Right now, of course, campuses are roiling with anti-Israel or pro-Palestine protests. But we're actually going to talk about something a little different. And rumors are circulating that the United States will enact the Lehi law against an IDF unit called Netzach Yehuda, which would essentially cut off funding for this unit. That announcement, it's being reported, could come around next Monday, or actually not at all, according to a report we read a few minutes ago on an Israeli website called Ynet. But currently, the Kfir Brigade's Netzach Yehuda is operating under the Gaza Division's Northern Brigade in Beit Hanun, in Gaza. And they're either currently right inside Gaza or directly on its border. So, Chaviv, we're going to talk about this, of course, because you were actually kind of around when this brigade was founded. And it was created so that ultra-Orthodox and other religious scholars can serve without feeling they're compromising their beliefs. But really, the question is that what it turned out to be? Or is it more of like a receptacle for disenfranchised rabble-rousers?
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. I mean, it's one of these small things that's really a very big thing because it's a signal of a much larger story. The Netzach Yehuda unit, which is this, it used to be part of the Nachal, not the Nachal Infantry Brigade, but something called the Nachal Command, which has an ancient history from really 48. Used to be called, you know, the Haredi Nachal, if you're looking up its history. But this unit has a fascinating history. It's a social work project, essentially. And over the course of the last few years, there have been repeated incidents of apparently, potentially, profoundly problematic actions by the soldiers on the ground in the West Bank. And it's led people to talk about a culture. in the unit that is okay with abuse, that sees no, you know, that soldiers don't get punished for misbehavior at checkpoints, for mistreating Palestinians. There have been a couple cases. The one that became most famous, partly because it was an old man, an 80-year-old man, partly because he also had American citizenship, was an old man who was tied up for very briefly. It was they were questioning people at a checkpoint. Several people were had their hands tied and told to sit on the side. And this old man lost consciousness. And the soldiers left and left him tied up. And he died. And the questions that then arose are what was happening, the investigation by the army, which has been criticized by some people, and I don't understand, concluded that he had fallen asleep. Now, an 80-year-old man with his hands tied, sitting on the, put on the side by soldiers, suddenly falls asleep, and the soldiers just leave without untying his hands or checking for his well-being. The army's version of what happened, to me, is profoundly problematic. But all of that story of the culture of the unit and the things that have really put the unit on the radar of the United States are part of a much deeper and more interesting story. Netzach Yehuda reflects a lot of changes that are happening in Israeli society, in conservative Israeli society, in Haredi Israeli society, on the far right that isn't Haredi. And it's worth, I think, diving into the history of the unit to talk about what it is we're talking about it, and whether or not the problems that this unit has had, the real problems. I mean, I don't mean to talk about it in this clean, sanitized language. There have been abuses, and the abuses have to be looked at and dealt with. They have been to some extent. I tend to think not enough. So it's worth talking about the sort of deeper history, I think.
Okay, so you called it initially a social project or a social work project in a way, because it isn't only for religious soldiers who want to be religious in the army, because in many of the units, they give time to pray. There's ample opportunity for religious soldiers to be religious in the army. And in fact, many of the top units right now are filled with religious soldiers. It's also the idea that no women will be around, which in itself, in my opinion, may be part of the reason why their somewhat problematic behavior is left unchecked. But let's put that to the side. So it's not only, we're saying, religious soldiers, it's not only that it's ultra-Orthodox soldiers, but it's also those who are on the fringes of these societies who have been gathered together. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, Haredi society, yes, absolutely. Haredi society has a problem, and it's had this problem for generations. And that is that it has this ideal of a learning society of young men who all go to study at yeshiva and at the seminary and spend their life essentially in study, or at least their young life. They then maybe enter the workforce later in life because they have kids, but they spend significant years of their life in study. Ultra-Orthodox rabbis and the community as a whole believes that, and there's a lot of diversity here among Sephardim who vote Shas. There's a lot of military service, actually, but then the question becomes, well, who exactly gets to be defined as ultra-Orthodox and Haredi and who not? Long story short, in the ultra-Orthodox community, especially the Ashkenazi one, there is a problem of young men who cannot study. They cannot sit all day long and do the work. It's not in their personality. It's not how their brain works. What the Germans called Sitzfleisch, right, which literally means the flesh of your buttocks, but it is the capacity to park yourself in a chair and learn and read and study. And these kids, because there isn't really in Haredi society, or it certainly wasn't 30 years ago, other respectable outlets that their families consented to or agreed to, a lot of these kids, and some of them came from homes that were very troubled in other ways, drop out of yeshiva and don't really have anywhere else to go. They were raised in an education system that doesn't teach them a whole lot of math or English, and they essentially fall into the streets, and they're living in the streets, and the rabbis, the rabbinical establishment, went looking for a solution. The Israeli army has a long history. Noar Ful, right, which was a unit organized by Rafael Eitan, the former chief of staff, of these troubled youth from broken homes who in the army found themselves, learned discipline, learned responsibility, and built some of, you know, the most illustrious units the army has today. The army has a long history of these kinds of social work projects, taking troubled youth and helping them make something of their lives, find their discipline, find their strength. And the rabbis, a group of rabbis, founded a nonprofit that came to the army with this request. Please build us a unit where we can send you what are essentially the fallen boys of the ultra-Orthodox world. We don't want them to secularize. This is to rescue them. And part of rescuing them is keeping them within the community. So what we need from the army, from the Israeli army, is to help keep them Haredi. That's part of their rehabilitation. And to set them on a respectable path. Now, the Israeli army has a history of helping communities with these kinds of requests, right? So there is a Muslim clergy in the Bedouin battalion established at the Bedouin community's request for Bedouin soldiers who are Muslim. And so the army said yes. And there was this unit established right around, I don't remember the exact year, I think it was 1999 or 2000, because when I got to them in 2001, well, this unit had a problem. As you say, they can't serve with women. Not being able to serve with women in the year 2000 in the IDF means they can't take most of the courses the IDF offers and that you need. So you can't build an infantry battalion without, I think in every platoon, a combat medic. But the medics course is taught by a great many women trainers and various, you know, Hummer drivers and sniper school, a lot of this stuff, women who don't serve in the combat roles, but they do train the combat soldiers. So the army had to go out to the larger army and actually ask for volunteers to come to this new Haredi unit who have this training in order to bring these capabilities into the unit. And I heard that there was a unit where you are required, it's mandatory to go to a rabbi's class every day. Prayer is mandatory. The food is very kosher, glatt kosher and mehadrin kosher, which is a level of kashrut I don't need and I don't think tastes all that good. So I tend to not, I'm going to get a lot of back, feedback from that. But I stand by that remark. Regular kosher tastes better than mehadrin kosher. Apologies. You should know if you are mehadrin, you are sacrificing for your beliefs. That is a noble thing. Point is, I heard about this unit and I thought this is an amazing idea. What a way to really live intellectually while also, I'll tell you a dark secret about military service. Don't tell anybody. This is just between us. It's stultifyingly boring. It is the most boring thing anyone ever does in their lives. And after 11 months of terrible boredom, suddenly there's a terror attack for 6 minutes. And so it's this boring, boring, boring. And this is describes, I think, the second intifada period. Right now in Gaza, I think there's more fighting, less boredom, but there's a lot of boredom. And this is a unit with an intellectual life. And that's what I thought. And I went, I agreed, I volunteered, I went to the unit and I served there for about a year and a half. I discovered something astonishing. First of all, in the first cohorts, I was a combat medic with cohort 2, literally the second group ever drafted, and it was, I don't think it was 25 guys, maybe 30 guys. I was then company command staff with cohort 4, and I was company medic for cohort 6 while they went through basic training, and then I finished my military service. Between cohort 2 and 6, we already, in other words, within the space of 2 years, a year and a half, we already saw the shift. It began as a Haredi social welfare project. It was these kids from broken homes, kids whose families burned their strimals. The strimal is the big fur hat that costs tens of thousands of shekels, which it's one of the big investments. When the strimal is burned, these are very extreme. One guy came from the Toldot Aharon Hasidic group, which is as anti-Zionist as Satmar. And the idea that he's in the army was this horrifying thing to the family. And there was a lot of these different kinds of stories. And by cohort 6, we were already at company size. I mean, full strength. I mean, a company would have 80, 90 guys. And 80, 90 guys, of whom a third, maybe, were actually Haredi. Who were the rest? The rest were what we call Chardal, which is a mushing together of the word Haredi Leumi, national Haredi. National Haredi are not Haredim who became Zionist nationalists. National Haredi are religious Zionists who religiously tilted a little more conservative. And the Chardalnikim are basically the voting base of the far right of the Religious Zionism Party, the right-wing end, maybe of Itamar Ben-Gvir. This is the political far right of Israeli politics. And these yeshivas said, hey, there's a unit in the army with a higher level of religious observance, mandatory for the soldiers. You have to volunteer to the unit because they can't force you to take a rabbi's class unless you volunteered, right? But these yeshivas started urging and these families and also the soldiers themselves who grew up in these communities started urging them to go to this unit. And this unit essentially within, I think, five cohorts became majority, probably more Chardal than anything Haredi. So that happened very early on. It still has the roots of social welfare. There are Haredi soldiers who go there. But what the army discovered pretty early is that a lot of Haredi soldiers are worried about combat. Combat units are the place where it's very hard to maintain a Haredi lifestyle. And so the army has slowly opened up non-combat tracks that are much easier to hold on to a Haredi lifestyle and critical ones in intelligence. The Air Force has an entire track for engineers and technicians who are Haredi. And there you fulfill an absolutely vital service to the country. Also, you're on a base. It's easier to live as a Haredi lifestyle while serving. So the army has all these other tracks and they really are Haredi. The Haredi Nachal, Netzach Yehuda, is a unit that, because it started out trying to be a social welfare program for Haredim, essentially became a battalion that is most identified in the entirety of the Israeli military with the political far right. And it happened in this very natural way. It wasn't a focused thing that people wanted to do. So that's the unit. That's the background. That's where it comes from.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
In many ways, today in Israeli society, it seems like the Lost Boys from Peter Pan, that a lot of these kids are coming from the hilltop youth and from things of that nature, that these boys were just basically left to their own devices. And it could be from as early as, I don't know, 14 years old. Maybe some of them have gone through some programs to be rehabilitated, and then they get drafted and they have to go somewhere. So they're kind of stuck into this unit. But at the same time, there's also this kind of, I don't know, idea that it is this so-called Haredi unit. And so there's even, for example, a Memorial Day ceremony. It's been already 5 years in a row that this unit's foundation, the foundation of Netzach Yehuda, is sponsoring a big Memorial Day ceremony in order to show Israel that, hey, these people are part of the Israeli society too. They're dying for our country just like everyone else. And in the last ceremony, for example, it had Jerusalem's chief rabbi, Shlomo Amar, the communications minister, the minister within the education ministry, Chaim Biton, then, who is, I believe, Shas, and also heritage minister, Amichai Eliyahu, I think also Shas. So that's kind of an interesting group to have up on stage showing off this so-called Haredi unit. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's, you know, We laid out here the social complexity. A minority of its soldiers today are actually Haredi. But what a lot of people hope for it to be, there's a reason that the Sephardi chief rabbi wants this unit to look Haredi. It's not because he wants Israel to see Haredim serving in the army. He does want that, I think. But mostly he wants Haredim to see Haredim serving in the army, because in the Sephardi community, it's not a taboo in the way it is in the Ashkenazi Haredi, or in large parts of the Ashkenazi Haredi community. But it's, and it's worked. In other words, when I was a company medic for these Haredi soldiers, first of all, the scale of the trouble into which some of these kids had fallen is really awful. I mean, we'd seen, I can't talk about it here because, there are hundreds of them, and this doesn't, you know, but nevertheless, if I say it'll awaken suspicion, but they'd really suffered. They'd suffered in the streets, and they'd suffered from their families, some of them, and they had really, some of them had become basically homeless. The army funded for them apartments they could go back to that were, you know, cold and unfurnished, but nevertheless were apartments. So there were real social work issues happening in this unit. One of the things that I think the soldiers were suffering the most from was going home, right? In the army, military unit in training goes home on the Shabbat, on the weekend, and these soldiers on their way off base would slip into a bathroom, change out of their military uniform and into their Haredi uniform, basically. If they showed up in their military uniform on their street in Maa Shearim, in this very ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem, very conservative, very Ashkenazi neighborhood in Jerusalem, they could face violence in the streets. They could face people saying, don't come and draft our children to the army. You are the ruination of this community. You are dragging us all to a bad place. You're secularized. Now, these are kids going to the army as a way to come back into good standing, into a community, into the... They going home for them was traumatic. The community didn't want them to exist. Soldiers, Haredi soldiers, they didn't want them dead. They didn't want there to be Haredi soldiers. Today, when those soldiers go back in their uniform to the Haredi community, they're held up by Haredi leaders, by rabbis, as evidence to other Israeli Jews, see, we also serve. Not everybody, not everywhere, but more than you'd think, most, in fact, don't want Haredim to become at a large scale serving in the Israeli army, but are proud that some do. Once upon a time, they were horrified and terrified that anyone would and marginalized and tried to ignore or literally push out of their neighborhoods anyone who actually went to the army. So there's been this real change, and it's a change that the leadership wanted. And so there's an acceptance now, and it's part of the larger Haredi sort of Zionification, becoming Zionist, which we've seen in the Haredi community generally. Even in parts of the Haredi community, like Hasidut Gur, the Gur Hasidic movement, which is, I think, the largest Hasidic movement in Israel, and its representative leads the United Torah Judaism list. Back in the day when its representative was Minister Yaakov Litzman in the government, the Gur Hasidic movement wouldn't have a ministry, wouldn't sit as a minister in the Israeli government because that's too Zionist. So they would only be a deputy minister. When that idea was challenged in court, that you don't have a minister, but you only have a deputy minister, the Gerer Rebbe suddenly agreed to have Yaakov Litzman be minister. That was about, I don't know how, say 7-8 years ago. And 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the ministers and deputy ministers from the Haredi community wouldn't take part in Memorial Day services. You're talking now about the Haredi Nachal having Memorial Day services on purpose to show Israelis that they also have had sacrifices and served the country. 15 years ago, the Haredi community shunned the Memorial Day as a whole, because not because they don't care that Jews die in defense of other Jews, but because you don't commemorate the way the Goyim commemorate. And today, those ministers from the Haredi parties lead services, lead ceremonies on Memorial Day commemorating soldiers in official ceremonies all over Israel, including Ashkenazi, including the Ger Chassid, who is the head of the United Torah Judaism list. So the change has been profound, and the Haredi willingness to join the army has changed with it. It's still a small phenomenon. It's a few hundred a year, but nevertheless, it exists, and it is accepted in a way it wasn't 15 years ago, and I saw personally from up close that change. It is genuinely a profound change.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
So you already mentioned the death of Omar Asad, which is, of course, being held up by the United States right now when there are these rumors or talks about not exactly sanctions, but more of a blacklist on this particular IDF unit. And of course, there are many other things that have been reported. In August 2022, for example, some of the Netzach Yehuda soldiers were filmed beating two Palestinian detainees in the West Bank in a video that was posted to TikTok, shared widely, and three soldiers were seen repeatedly kicking two Palestinian men near Ramallah as a fourth soldier just stood along nearby. They were investigated and suspended, etc. But at that time, in August 2022, Israel's Minister of Diaspora Affairs, who was Nachman Shai, called for the unit to be shut down. And I'll just remind our listeners, Nachman Shai was the IDF spokesman from 1988 to 1991, including during the Gulf War. And he is somebody who knows the army pretty well, or at least the army of his era, from the inside. So if Nachman Shai is saying that the army cannot deal with these soldiers, Chaviv, do you really think that it can?
Absolutely, it can. No question that it can. I say that as a statement that the Israeli army knows how to exact punishment from soldiers who misbehave, must exact punishment from soldiers who misbehave. I also say that, I mean, that's I don't know if you would call it right wing, but yes, the army does and can deal with bad behavior among soldiers. And that also, of course, has a corollary, which let's call it left wing, which is if it doesn't, it can be called out for it. And it doesn't sometimes, and it has to be called out for it. And in the case of this particular unit, there's no army in the history of warfare that went to war without problems, without abuses. The standards are rising. That's really nice. It's a little bit difficult that the standards seem to rise for us and not for others. But nevertheless, and that's another podcast, but the Israeli soldiers, there will be problems in every unit. This specific unit, because it is so politically identified, people are not surprised that it also has more than average cases of alleged abuse, of serious problems in discipline, of Palestinians reporting things that these soldiers have done. Often there's a lot of evidence. Sometimes there isn't evidence. But there are reports. And so this is a unit that can do great things. There are soldiers there who come from problematic places and really need this path back to a normal life. It is also a unit that, because of its religious identity and because of the religious environment it tries to provide, draws far-right soldiers, politically far-right soldiers, and needs to be hyper aware of that, and therefore more disciplined, and therefore more alert to potential problems. Nachman Shai might have been right. I'm not sure. If the army cannot if the army creates a unit that, because it's trying to provide a religious service, a religious environment that's comfortable for these people, ends up being a political unit, a politically identified unit with politically relevant problems, then maybe it should be shut down. And maybe all the other places where Haredim and troubled youth are drafted should be invested in more. And there should be these other ways that people can serve. I hope that's not true. I hope the army can buckle down and get the job done. We saw a report today that you sent me, you saw it first, that there is among Israeli officials some optimism that in fact there won't be sanctions leveled or blacklisting leveled against this unit. Not because the Americans have been convinced that there aren't problems, there is a problem, but because the Israelis have essentially vowed that they'll fix it. They will do whatever it takes to not create the precedent in which the United States starts handing out sanctions to specific Israeli units. It's a little bit embarrassing to me that it came to that. It's not a little bit. It's frustrating that it comes to that. That should be the Army's own priority. Again, the Army spends vast resources to not have abusive soldiers. No army in the history of warfare doesn't have abusive soldiers. It's not, you don't draft 300, 400, 500,000 people without having problematic people in that group, in that scale of population. But this is a specific place where a lot of problems can be solved with one serious concerted effort, and the army needs to do that. And if the Americans force the army to pay attention, I'm embarrassed, I'm ashamed, but it's good that they'll be paying that attention.
Right. It should be reminded that the Lehi law doesn't actually contain sanctions authority. Instead, it requires the U.S. to make assessments whether foreign militaries receiving aid have violated human rights. And it seems that there's ample evidence that the Netzach Yehuda unit has. And if such violations are identified and there haven't been steps taken to ensure accountability, then assistance to the particular unit is suspended. But it can be reinstalled as well, as long as the remedies are implemented. So right now we're at a point in which the U.S. has not yet announced that there will be this Lehi law enacted against Netzach Yehuda. Of course, there were even rumors last week or earlier this week that other IDF units may be included on this list. It's not a sanction in the classic sense that can be imposed by the State Department or the Treasury Department. It seems like more of a, in a way, a review and a way of getting this kind of unit outside of U.S. military drills in the meantime. So we'll see.
I don't know. Look, if it's the unit itself as a unit as a whole isn't a problem, right? I'm doing air quotes. Soldiers have done difficult, problematic, wrong, abusive sometimes things, and sometimes is far too much. That is not a thing that can be allowed to happen or go unpunished. If you want to focus in on this unit, that's not completely nonsensical because it has this specific history that makes it specifically political in specific ways. If you then want to expand it to all kinds of other military units and just sort of willy-nilly toss this thread around, be very careful. Because if you just toss the threat around constantly, it'll lose something. If you want the Israelis to focus in on a specific problem and you're frustrated that they're not, I do have some respect for that. But it isn't the units as a whole. It doesn't, you know, you're going to kick them out of drills. I mean, Netzach Yehuda is a what we call mechanized infantry in the Israeli army, which means that it trains not for a full-blown infantry war, but it does a lot of what the Israeli army calls bitachon shotef, ongoing security. So that's a lot of West Bank, a lot of borders. Right now, they actually were in the north on the northern border for a while, but they're not the first frontline units meeting the civilians as they move into Lebanon. That if there is a Lebanon war, that is not their role. They're a lower level infantry battalion. I love them. I serve there. I have t-shirts from it, but nevertheless, it is not the most elite infantry of the Israeli army, and it is also one of the things that a colleague of ours mentioned at an editorial meeting about this decision, why he found it a little bit odd, is that they were actually pulled out of the West Bank 2 years ago. They haven't actually been in the West Bank, so the timing of this is very strange, which is to say, he didn't say this, I'm saying this, political. In other words, it's about looking, the Biden administration looking like it's doing something rather than throwing around this dramatic statement rather than, now for the Israelis, that's a problem because it's setting a real precedent that could be problematic going forward. But if that focuses the mind to correct the problem, great. If the whole thing is driven by American domestic politics, then no amount of Israeli correcting is going to fix it. And then maybe this is a pivot of something much larger.
I mean, Chaviv, if you think about it, the Biden administration is walking a very thin tightrope, and especially even thinking about it this particular week. We just heard this morning that the Senate passed the aid bill. And so Israel, on the one hand, is getting vast amounts of money, I believe $17 billion, and another, if I'm not mistaken, $9 billion in very amorphous humanitarian aid that may go to Gaza or other places. We don't quite know, and don't check me on those numbers. Actually, maybe we should check those numbers.
Yeah,
let's check those numbers.
Yeah, let's say it right the first time. I agree.
Oh, I was actually right.
17 plus 9?
Yeah.
No, I think the $9 billion for Palestinians is real. It's not amorphous. It's just difficult. It's hard to know how to spend it in Palestine without it being UNRWA, which Biden still hasn't fully refunded. I mean, I think that is going to go to the Palestinians.
No, it'll go to the Palestinians. It's just unclear whether it goes to Gaza, or if parts goes to Gaza, $2 billion goes to Gaza, or, you know, how it's going to be split up seems a bit amorphous at this point. But my point is that this is a week in which Biden, on the one hand, or the Biden administration, on the one hand, has pushed through huge amounts of aid for Israel, and at the same time needs to mitigate this and seem kind of balanced. And so, of course, it announced sanctions last week on certain, you know, people such as Bensi Gopstein, you know, who is a very well-known settler extremist, I'll just say that, and other smaller, you know, fundraising organizations. And this rumor started circulating at the same time. So it seems to me that, yeah, it is political, but it has to be this kind of balancing act.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, they are looking at sanctioning for abuses in the West, or blacklisting in some way for abuses in the West Bank, a unit that hasn't been in the West Bank for a long time. And Bensi Gopstein is a great example of the kind of, well, of why a lot of Israelis see this as posturing. Bensi Gopstein is opposed to inter-ethnic and interfaith marriage, opposed to the point where he will gather together a group of hooligans to protest literally outside of wedding halls where a wedding between a Muslim and a Jew, or a Christian and a Jew, are happening. So Bensi Gopstein is a outright racist, and if he sues me for saying that, I would very gladly be sued for that, and has very little support among Israelis, and therefore sanctioning him is not a way of getting on the bad side of Israelis, and it's not a terrible idea that you would not want him in America, right? So they go to these extreme right, far, far right, represent, you know, almost no one in Israeli, or the right wing 3% of Israeli, whatever it is. They sanction there, and then they send 15 or 17 or whatever it was, billion dollars to Israel's war effort. It does look like a game, and it's a shame that it's a game, because they're playing with fire. You want to create a precedent for blacklisting Israeli soldiers? Do it seriously. You want to do it just as political cover? Maybe you need to handle your political problems a little more cleverly and seriously and not play games with these things. The Netzach Yehuda Battalion, while it has had these abuse problems and it has this problematic culture, and the army must deal with it, also is full of incredibly brave soldiers who have run into fire to protect this country from people who want to destroy and murder all of us. So if you do this poorly, you will get Israelis. You will get a lot of Israelis who, I'm sorry, it's making me laugh. It's a little bit of shooting yourself in your own foot. The Israeli political left or center left is worried about this unit. Don't take this unit and begin to treat it this way without clarity and without a clear policy and without a clear statement of what you want it to do to fix it. Because if you do that, then Israelis won't think it's substantive. And they will think that in this moment where soldiers have fought in Gaza and have fought for our safety and will potentially be fighting in Lebanon, you are now punishing them mid-war for your own politics and political posturing. So that, I think, for the Americans would be a mistake. It would actually push the Israeli public in the opposite direction from the statement the administration is trying to make. It doesn't, I think, help what the administration is trying to do.
Khabib, thank you so much for joining me for another informal What Matters Now conversation.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to this week's What Matters Now. Please check out another installment next week. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until next week, shalom.